All right, so my talk actually shares something in common with the previous talk, and that I've chosen to use alliteration in my title. And I'm hoping I won't get in this. I had thought I would not get in any trouble with words, edges, and excitations, except there was some discussion about edges yesterday and surfaces, and I hope I won't get in trouble with that. I might. So, in fact, a lot of this talk is to deal with edges in the quantum Hall regime. We saw some pictures of dead space in the quantum Hall regime yesterday. And really, I want to talk in a little more detail about those edge states and why they come out the way they do. Because there's interesting physics actually hiding in there. So that will basically be this. I'll quickly read some things we already heard. And then talk about what happens in zigzag or armchair edges in terms of non-interacting edge states, and then I want to talk about some of the interesting physics you get when you introduce quantum Hall ferromagnetism into this problem. And then I almost certainly will not have time to talk about excitons. I hope that I'd be able to because of some of the recent experiments, and in fact they're connected to what we heard from Philip Kim today. Probably I won't get to it. If I don't, if you're interested, please come find me or Louise, and we can tell you about it. This work is collaboration that I did with Kevin and Louise Gray. And this last part, Drew Ingar and Jennifer Huang, who are respectively postdoc and student with me, were also involved. Okay, so this is the sort of thing we've been seeing in the last couple of days, quantum Hall effects in the blocking system. This is from the Manchester group. What's special here is that we have basically our first step in the plateau is actually half the height of the subsequent step. There's no plateau here, at least at relatively low fields, at nearly equal zero, so that this is a little bit different than the standard quantum Hall effect. And we can understand that from a very simple point of view if we just look at the bulk Landau levels for a graphene sample. And both Kim's group and put this in their paper, which shows the density states associated with that. And the important physics for this is that if the sample is nominally undoped, then the Fermi energy would actually be in this Landau band here. And a very simple explanation for quantum Hall effect is that we need to completely fill the band in order to get the quantized Hall conductivity. So that at nu equals zero, we don't actually have a plateau, basically, until we put in enough electrons to fill this thing up. And then you get your first plateau at 2 e squared over h. And then the subsequent Landau levels can be filled if you put in twice as many electrons as you need to put into the first one, and that's why the subsequent steps are bigger. So that's sort of the back of the envelope type of explanation for what's going on. There is, as you heard from Joe Kim, some very subtle and interesting things going on at nu equals zero. I don't want to really talk about that, although I think those are worth trying to understand. So I'm going to run through some formalism here, which I think most people are familiar with, but I need to establish a little bit of notation, so let me just do this quickly. When we try to write down a continuum theory for graphene, the standard way of proceeding is using the K dot P approximation. We focus on the envelope part of the wave function. And then in writing down Schrödinger's equation, we basically have gradients, and we do this minimal coupling to introduce the magnetic field. So this operator now acts just on the envelope part of the wave function. We're going to work, I'm only going to talk about the problem in the magnetic field. Let me choose a gauge here, like so, and then we'll be able to introduce some Landau level raising operators and the corresponding lowering operators. In this particular gauge, Kx is a good quantum number here. I'm going to switch from x, because I'm going to change x and y a little later. Sorry about that. Who knows I did that? In any case, these wave functions, of course, run along one direction and are confined perpendicular to it, just like standard electron gas. So what happens to the continuum equation, then, or the version you get of the Dirac equation with the magnetic field present, looks like this and this. And this is basically the equation for the envelope functions when they are near the bottom of the K valley. Remember, there are two equivalent points, K and K prime valley for graphene. So we just have this sort of unusual structure in which we have the raising and lowering operators for the Landau level actually off-diagonal, so that we not only change Landau level index with this, but when this Hamiltonian axon, this spinner, with this being A sublattice and this being the B sublattice amplitude, we also interchange the A and B sublattices, and that's going to be important for what I have to say below. So this very similar structure for what becomes the Dirac equation for the wave functions near the bottoms of the two valleys, or two Dirac points. Okay. So you've all probably seen what the wave functions finally look like. They're just, again, lambda-level wave functions. The interesting thing here is that the lambda-level index is actually different depending on which sublattice you're on. So, for example, in the B sublattice, I might have a larger lambda-level index than to the A sublattice, and it's the other way around for the other Dirac point. One of the interesting things that happens here is that when we're at the lowest lambda level, when n equals 0, when there's really no phi minus 1 wave function, what that really means is that there's a 0 for the amplitude on one of the sublattices. So the lowest lambda level lives on one of the sublattices for one of the values, and on the other sublattice, the other value. And that shows that the lowest lambda level is a little bit different than the higher lambda levels. And this is going to be reflected in the edge case structure, where the lowest lambda level also has a little bit of different structure than the higher lambda level. The energies here, we've been hearing about, they're well known. They go square root of the quantum number rather than the quantum number itself, as for regular two-dimensional electron gas. And so our spectrum has this famous positive and negative energy space, which are kind of particle hole partners of one another. And then at n equals 0, at zero energy, we have states which are their own particle hole. So we do have two of these for the K and K prime, and then times two for that if you want to do the spin. For a few minutes, I'm not going to talk about spin, but I'll put it back in. Yes?
So, is there a simple way to see why the order of the lambda index in the spinner is reversed for the K and K prime point?
I think you just have to do the band structure and expand it into two points and use it without that line.
Four months capture from four by four Dirac algebra representation of two dimensions.
So it comes out.
But yeah. I think we're not that way. There was some mysterious way in which the A signs would be different from the B signs. And somehow A would be special, would be populated, and B. So it cannot be. You have to go and be able to go from one to
the other. Oh, you mean that otherwise?
Yeah, otherwise you would have all the A signs. Yeah. Somehow you know it's arbitrary, which you call A and B.
Right,
and
that's called an arbitrary.
If you make the simple space of squared the Dirac Hamiltonian, then you get the Schrödinger Hamiltonian magnetic field with the quasi semantor, which
and
is that.
We'll do that. Okay. All right. Anyway, so I guess I said this earlier. We have this fourfold degeneracy when we include spin and valley for each of these levels. Okay. So I gave you the sort of simple explanation just in terms of the bulk. In terms of the bulk spectrum, but we wanted to understand how quantum Hall effect is working in the system from the viewpoint of edge space. And there are a couple of reasons to think about that. One is that the samples, at least the first experiments we saw reported, were in fairly narrow samples, and that's a regime where you might think that edge state transport could be pretty important. Another thing is we'll see the edge states are kind of interesting. They're in some ways different than the standard edge states for the usual two-dimensional electron gas. And one thing that's nice about graphene is that you could imagine bringing an STM probe close to the sample and really looking on a microscopic scale at things like local density of states. And this is something that's totally impossible with the standard systems that we're used to thinking about for quantum Hall effect, which are buried inside a semiconductor. So you can't get a probe closer than the top of the sample. And that sets a limit on your resolution. And that limit is in principle not present for graphene, and we might learn a lot more about the microscopic structure of the electron states than was ever possible before. So this is, I think, one of the things that's very exciting about being able to look at graphene as opposed to the usual two-dimensional electron gas. Okay, let me just quickly remind you about edge state transport. This is, again, kind of a cartoon for one lambda level from this standard two-dimensional electron gas, and one of the things we learned many years ago is that the energy of the states, this is now the guiding center coordinate, which is basically one of the, is like the momentum of quantum number kx, so I called kx previously, times magnetic field, magnetic length squared. And when this quantum number, when this guiding center coordinate gets close to the edge, then the energy disperses upward on either edge. Okay, and that dispersion tells us that there's actually currents at the edges of the sample, even in equilibrium. But if we're in equilibrium, the edge currents, of course, are equal and opposite. There's no net current in equilibrium. But what Bert Halperin told us in 1982 was we can think about edge transport by saying that we have different chemical potentials for either edge, so that we now have unequal carved onto it. It's now a net current across the sample, but that comes at a price of having a chemical potential difference between the two edges, which we can translate into a voltage difference. So this gives us a Hall voltage, or a Hall effect. And then if you work out what the Hall coefficient is, or the Hall resistivity is, it turns out it depends only on the number of pairs of the number of pairs of edge states that you have crossing the Fermi level in equilibrium. That's what this N is here, and basically it's the number, naively you think it's the number of lambda levels that are built up.
The experiment you're proposing is one in which the STM tip goes to the edge, and you add or remove a charge from the edge. Is that what?
I will talk about that. I haven't said that.
That energy E is...
Which energy are you talking about?
You plot an energy.
This? No, this is just the non-interacting edge state.
Ground state energy.
It's the non-interacting single particle energy. I'm just talking about how edge state transport works. It's a little bit different than what I said. It's a little separate from what I said the last time. So the only point I wanted to make here is that a Hall resistivity tells us something about how many edge state channels are crossing the Fermi energy. And of course that's relevant because it's telling us that because we had a step height that's only half the size, and the first step is half the size of all the subsequent steps, that would tell us the number of edge channels crossing the Fermi energy has to actually be smaller than in higher lambda levels. And we want to see how that worked out. Now we've seen pictures, again, like I said yesterday, that show that it's indeed true. So I'm going to re-show these pictures. These are ones we've done ourselves, and some of them probably were done before us, and some of them after. But they're well-known pictures of what you get from high binding calculations of graphene in ribbon geometry with a perpendicular magnetic field. So this particular geometry has zigzag edges, magnetic field coming out of the board here. This is the direction of the K&K prime point with respect to the way we've oriented the sampling. Okay, so this is telling us actually that we should be able to see we should be able to see the Y projection of the K&K prime points, and indeed we do. So when you solve the high binding model, you get your lambda levels, and these are that are fairly flat, and you can look at these and see that they go as square root of N as you would expect. And the thing here to notice is that these regions here where the energy goes up, if you look at the wave functions, you see the wave functions are localized near the edges of the sample. So these are just the edge states. Of course, that's true over here too. These are also edge states. This is basically edge state for the right edge associated with the K valley, and this would be left edge associated with the K prime valley. The thing that's important to notice here is that although the higher lambda levels have some edge state structure here, we don't seem to have it to the lowest lambda level. This is one of the things we want to understand. If this is going to give us the right answer, we seem to have basically only one pair of edge states here, and after that we're going to have two. So the first step is going to be half the subsequent steps. It's the right answer. But why? Why did it come out this way? Well, let's see if we can understand that. Okay. So we want to understand this in a continuum theory using the Dirac equation. And really, the only thing that we had to figure out is what is the right boundary condition to impose. And eventually, we came up with a very simple criterion. Just looking at what the structure looks like for the zigzag edge, you can see that basically we have a row of atoms all from the same lattice that are missing. And so where you cut the sample, basically. And so we said, well, let's just set the wave function to zero on the B sublattice. And it turns out you can do that without admixing valleys in any way. So you can do it separately for each of the valleys and figure out the states for each of them. So there's our boundary condition. To solve this, we do what we suggested a moment ago. We'll square the Hamiltonian. We'll act with the Hamiltonian twice on the wave function. Then you get a simple scalar relation. The B dagger and B now are coming in such that this really just looks like the usual harmonic oscillator problem you have to solve when you're doing lambda levels. And we can look just at phi b, for example, and then when we want to figure out what phi a is, well, then we go back to the original Dirac equation and act with one of these operators on phi b, divide by the energy, and you're given phi a. So once I solve this, I don't really have to exactly solve the equation to get phi a. I just act on an operator on phi b, and I get whatever phi a is. And there's something similar, of course, that happens with the other valence. Okay, so for the higher lambda levels, when I impose this boundary condition, basically get the same result that you would have gotten for the standard two-dimensional electron gas. But it turns out something different happens in the lowest lambda level. Okay. I've lost track of time.
You still have 10 minutes.
Okay.
Slightly more.
Slightly more.
Quarter more.
Okay. So why is it different? So let's look first at these kinds of edge states over here, where we have some dispersion of the function of the dividing center coordinate. In the lowest lambda level, let's see what happens with these equations. I can solve for phi b again in the usual way, and then I would get my phi a by acting as a lowering operator. But the lowest lambda level is a little bit special, because in the lowest lambda level, if phi b is completely in the lowest lambda level, then acting with this will just simply give me zero, right? Lowering operator on a wave function lowest lambda level is annihilated. So the only place that this is different than zero is near, very close to the edge, where we have to set the wave function to zero. When we set the wave function to zero, we necessarily have these higher lambda levels, and that's where phi a will be different than zero. And so we get a sort of a strange structure in which we have nearly Gaussian wave functions on the B sublattice, which are actually, in this particular example, I can't even show it, it's so far away from what's happening on the A sublattice. So I have this nearly sort of perfect Gaussian. There's a little something that happens in the Gaussian here near the edge, which I can't quite see, which I haven't tried to show you anyway. But that's where, when I act with this B operator, I get a non-zero support for phi A. And so you get this component of the wave function on the A sublattice, actually several magnetic lengths, quite possibly several magnetic lengths away from the center of the wave function phi B. And that's what's happening actually sort of over here, where you have very little dispersion. These things are very strongly, it's a funny thing, they're very tightly localized to the surface as well. This size scale here is actually quite small compared to the magnetic length. It's sort of an unusual thing that you can get small size scales in a wave function in the lowest lambda level without, it's not really the lowest lambda level, but without, and it's sort of the lowest energy states, things much smaller than magnetic length, but you just can't get them. This is one way in which you can get it. Another thing I should say, it's not so obvious from what I've shown you, is that the total amplitude, the total probability of finding the particle on the A sublattice is actually exactly the same as the total probability of finding it on the B sublattice. That comes from a symmetry, from the particle hole symmetry. I haven't shown you that directly. So even though this is very tightly localized and far away, you still have very substantial amplitudes to find the wave function near the surface of these things. Okay, so there's one interesting possibility here. This is a lot of things to think about before an experiment like this really was done, but nevertheless, I think something worth thinking about, and that is if we put the STM tip near the edge, and I think I borrowed this from one of Paco's and Antonio's papers, so thank you and Costa. Thank you for letting me use your picture, even though I didn't have.
You're welcome.
So, but we can imagine, in any case, injecting a particle into, let's say, this red type of site, let's say that's an A sublattice site. But the real wave functions are mixtures of the two types. And so, in principle, if we could do the non-interacting problem, we should get oscillations back and forth between basically way out here near the edge and further in the bulk, because basically we have to take a linear combination of the whole like and the particle like wave functions in order to localize electron just one little sublattice. So anyway, so those oscillations in principle would be there. I'm almost certain they'll be damped by many body effects that I haven't.
Sure, there's an exciton effect.
What's that?
You're moving charge from one point to another, so there's an exciton effect.
There's definitely many body effects, and we haven't thought about that yet. But nevertheless, it's an interesting problem
But how is it related to the energies you showed us before?
How is it related to the energy? It tells you the frequency of the oscillation. Yeah. So that's an interesting question. Remember that there's another part to the wave function on the B sublattice somewhere out here, and depending on how far you are from the edge, you'll be injecting into a wave function actually further out here, further in this way. So if I inject into something very close to the edge, I would be over here, and then this energy will tell me the frequency of oscillations, and that frequency will slow down as I inject it further and further into the bulk.
Sure, but I'm not sure what the expectation is for STM if I move the STM away. If I move the STM tip away from the edge.
Right, that, I was just saying that. As you go away from the edge, the frequency will change.
Frequency of what?
There will be oscillations between the surface part of the wave function and the part that's further in the bulk, between what's on the B sublattice and what's on the A sublattice. Okay, because I'm here, I'm injecting it into just one of the sublattices. So we would see oscillation, and
STM is measuring the L dose. So for instance, you would be looking at the particular
device. You have to do something time dependent here. You actually have to inject the particle and look at.
Or you can go to that result.
I'm not saying it's an easy experiment, but I'm a theorist. It doesn't have to be easy. The other part of this, which actually was sort of motivating why we looked at this, is what's happening over here in the Los Landa level, where we don't see any dispersion. And it's not that there aren't edge states. There are edge states in the Los Landa level over here. But again, going back to the way we solved the problem, you can see what happened. In this case, now I'm looking at the K prime valley, so I can solve the Schrodinger equation for phi A prime against the usual Schrodinger equation. But my boundary condition was on the phi D's, not the phi A's. So now if I take a wave function that really isn't the Los Landa level, just the Gaussian, for any Gaussian center coordinate I like, if I act on it with this lowering operator, it's going to annihilate the state. And so, of course, phi D prime will be zero at the edge, it'll be zero everywhere. And so these states over here simply live completely on one of the sublattices, and it's not deformed in any way by the edge. And because of that, we basically don't have any dispersion here. We have exactly the same energy we have for both of them. Yes, and we just have a defense. Yeah.
Is there dispersion in the middle just because you've chosen a strip which is three unit cells wide?
I don't understand what you mean.
The thing in the middle is nothing to, it shouldn't really be there.
You mean it's not, it doesn't necessarily have to be in the middle. Is that what you mean? I'm not sure what you mean.
There's no structure. The structures are all near the edge in anything that's larger than than a couple of atomic.
Right. Okay, I don't see anything inconsistent with what I said here.
No, he's talking about the edge states in the middle.
The dispersion you have there is to do with
you're normally parking
those.
Yeah.
Okay, and I'm sorry, so what are you asking me about? Those are states near the edge, that's right.
This is what is the function of ky, it's not the function of position of all this.
Function of the k.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I haven't shown what I meant. It is ky. This is just what comes out of doing the type binding.
So I guess this would be indistinguishable from solved in the ramp equation instead of tie binding, right?
Yeah,
basically. There's nothing in here which is particular for the tie binding.
No, I'm trying to understand why
the same.
I'm trying to say why the tie binding came out the way it did.
I thought that was the question here, whether this was peculiar for your, let's say, rather narrow strip, or whether you would get the same if you would solve a continuum mode.
No, it's. What I'm describing is in a continuum.
Okay.
This picture is from type binding. But then these calculations I'm talking about are in a continuum.
So the simple question, Herb, is that usually we're used to thinking of, that it's versus K or it's versus guidance header.
Right.
So in the middle of the curve is actually the middle of the sample, but that's not true.
That's not true here. The middle of the sample is here and also here, but they're in two different places in K space.
Yeah.
Like two sets of wave functions.
So the width of that is what in K?
The width of the whole thing. It's about the width of the whole thing.
One over lattice space.
Right. One over about 2 pi over A zero.
For instance.
Okay. All right. Let me do the armchair edge as well. Again, we saw these pictures yesterday. The armchair edge, the direction of the K and K prime vectors are now such that they'll kind of overlap each other when I have the ribbon running in this particular direction. This is what you get again from the type binding. Here's the scale of the K1. And again, you see that we have sort of pairs of edge states for high lambda levels, but then we have one electron length and one hole length for the lowest lambda level. Again, it's giving us the right answer. If I put my Fermi energy here, just running the lowest lambda level, I have one pair of edge states, but then when I go to the subsequent lambda levels, I have two pairs of edge states. The higher lambda levels have twice as big a step height as the lowest lambda level. But somehow it's coming out differently here again. And again, we want to understand how this happened. So again, it's just a question of choosing the right boundary condition. So you look at the picture and you see that for the armchair edge, now I have as many B sites as A sites right now. And so we guess that what we should do is set the wave function to zero for both types of lattice sites, but at the edge. But there's a problem with that. That is not, you can't stay in a single valley and do that. You have to admix the valleys in order to be able to get the wave function to vanish both on B and A and also be consistent with the Dirac equation. So this is our boundary condition. We're going to basically force the sums of these things to vanish. And I should have done this, but I didn't. I should probably change the sign of these things so that the difference that's vanishing, so that phi b and phi a, phi b and phi b prime match and phi a and phi a prime match. The reason is for that is the trick that we use to actually show how this works out, because Okay, so for example, I can, if I want to match this to that in terms of wave functions, then I have to ask, well, what's going to happen to phi A? Phi A and phi prime are related to phi B and phi B prime in this particular way, by random level raising and lowering operators. And when I plug in the meaning of these things, what that actually turns out to tell us is that the derivatives of phi B also have to match. So if I had chosen my signs on phi B prime and phi A prime, what I could have said is phi B has to equal phi B prime and the derivative of phi B has to equal the derivative of phi B prime. That was like a lot like the usual kind of boundary condition we use when we're solving a Schrodinger equation in a system that might be only piecewise continuous. And that's basically the idea we used to solve the problem. We said, let's put the wave function from one boundary, let's say a space of positive x, and then we'll put the wave function from the other boundary on a space of negative x. And then if I solve my boundary condition where these things join up correctly, I should solve the whole problem. Now, the interesting thing about this is remember that we had kind of a B dagger B structure for the squared Hamiltonian for the K valley. So that B dagger B gives us an effective quadratic potential that looks like this. But we have the B and B dagger interchanged in order for the other valley. It was B, B dagger. So if I put things in the right order, it's going to generate a constant. And so the effective quadratic potential you get is shifted relative to this one, relative to this one, but basically with amounts to h bar omega c, we use the right appropriate effective units. Okay. So what does that mean? That means that we have kind of effective well potential here and effective well potential here, and they're shifted by just the right amount that the bound states of this well match up with, let's say, the first, the lowest one here matches up with the first excited state here, and so on, right? If I pull these two wells further apart, which is what happens if I actually have KY bigger and bigger, I'll have more and more bound states, each of which corresponds actually to an edge state. These two will basically mix in symmetric and anti-symmetric combinations, and so we get the two edge states for the higher Landau levels, but the lowest energy state, the higher Landau level all by itself, is only one edge state for the lowest Landau level. And that's why the lowest Landau level ends up being different from the subsequent one. So it seems to happen in a very different way, but nevertheless, we end up with the right answer. We get a different number of edge states for the lowest Landau level. All right, how am I doing here?
5 minutes.
5 minutes. Right. So in 5 minutes, I'm not going to select everything you could possibly want to know about the effect of electron-electron interaction on these edge state properties, but I'm going to tell you one thing and probably a little bit too quickly. So the point of view we're taking here is that one of the things we know that electron-electron interactions do is induce quantum Hall ferromagnetism. It's preferable for electrons if they have discrete degrees of freedom in a Landau level to all go into the same discrete state, for example, into the same valley or into the same linear combination of valleys, so that basically you can minimize the exchange energy. And that effectively opens up a gap for states that would be degenerate without interactions. And so we know from other quantum Hall systems, standard two-decks, that you certainly can get this and see the quantum Hall effect, even in integer states that are induced by interaction. And something a lot like this, and what's seen in the data that Philip Kim showed us before, in particular, in high enough fields, he was able to show us in mu equals 1, so I guess that's this one over here, which could be basically quantum Hall ferromagnetism. So that's the simplest explanation, I would say. There are some more interesting explanations out there, but this certainly for us was the first thing that went into our mind. So, what is the consequence of this for the edge? Well, we saw this edge state structure for now an undoped graphene sample. We have both spins now, including the spin degrees of freedom. So we have two electron-like states and two hole-like states because of the spin degree of freedom. But when I introduce Zeeman coupling, they're going to split. Inside the bulk, we're going to get basically spin polarized electrons. But then as we head towards the edge, of course, the hole-like states are going to be the ones that fill up. And so there should be some transition from what's effectively a polarized state to one that's unpolarized very close to the edge. Now, when we include the effects of the quantum Hall ferromagnetism, we know something interesting is going to happen over here, because if this thing acts like a ferromagnet, everything is trying to point in the same direction, there's a big exchange energy cost to have the effective pseudo-spin suddenly change from one direction to another. And the way the system is going to handle this is by finding some compromise between the single particle energy and the exchange energy such that the pseudo-spin changes in a more or less continuous way. In other words, there'll be a domain law there. The domain wall is a fairly interesting structure, as I'll explain. So this is a wave function you can write down to capture the physics of the domain wall. The thetas here are variational parameters, and here we're going to basically, if we're all the way at the left, we're going to have our spin up states, and if we're all the way on the right, we have our spin down states, and then you want to see basically how quickly the weight goes from this to that as a function of as we move out towards the edge. Now, if you assume that that the length scale at which the weight goes from here to here is large on the scale of the magnetic length, then you can do a gradient expansion, and the energy actually, if you take the expectation value of this, the energy becomes something very simple. This is like a kind of sine Gordon type of energy functional. And so then you can easily minimize this numerically and the kind of result you get, something like this. And then just to show that everything's self-consistent, you see that the domain wall is indeed very large on the scale of the magnetic length, so the gradient expansion is okay. So we have this domain wall. And then it's got some interesting properties, which I'll run through quickly.
Non-interacting electrons?
No, this is interacting electrons now. It's an exchange of exchanges.
Including exchange.
Okay. Right, so that's the rho s. All my interactions here are hiding the rho s. Okay. Okay, so one thing about this state is that it is actually a broken symmetry state. If we think about these two spin directions of two states, which I have this degree of freedom to occupy, if you remember the wave function up here, we made these actually have the same phase, they're both real numbers, but if I like, I could put an e to the I phi here and have these two have different relative phases. And as long as the phase is not a function of x0, we find that the energy is exactly the same. So there's actually a degree of freedom here, a symmetry here, which we've broken by choosing that number to be 1, by choosing the phase to be 0. Now, the way you can understand this is that when we look at these two possible states as components of a spinner, what we've actually done is we've rotated from a spin up to a spin down as we approach the edge. And in the choice I made, the spin rotated through the x direction. But that's not the only possibility. It could have rotated through the y direction or really anything in between. In other words, in this spinner representation, we can do a global rotation around the z-axis. We can move these spins in the plane. As long as I move all of them together, it's not going to cost any energy to do so. So again, that says that this is a state with a broken U1 symmetry. It's a lot like basically a linear easy plane ferromagnet. So more or less right away, we recognize that the system is going to have a gapless collective mode that's associated with the spin wave for the sort of in-plane motion of these arrows here. Of course, when we have quantum fluctuation from that gapless mode, it's going to disorder the spin set and the mean field calculation I just showed you are ordered, but that's okay. It doesn't spoil the presence of the gapless mode. It will still be there even though we lose the long-range order. Another point is that I guess I don't really have time to do this in any detail, but it's known in the quantum Hall context that there's a spin-charge coupling, which means that when I produce rotations of an object like this, you actually accumulate a certain amount of charge, and I think this was, for this kind of structure, first pointed out by Bologia Falco for a very different type of problem, but one that's a little like this eventually when you do the effective model. So what this is saying is that if I introduce a 2-pi rotation of the in-plane spin down the length of this channel here, the domain wall, I'll actually add or subtract charge in the system. In fact, one 2-pi rotation would accumulate one extra charge, or even an electron, or take away an electron. And I can show you that in terms of wave functions and the gradient history, but I won't run through that. I think I'm over time already. So anyway,
this is real spin.
No, this is actually... I guess it is.
It's not pseudo spin.
It's a state with a certain spin and a certain valley, and a state with the other spin that's also the other valley.
So there is a mixture.
I'm thinking of it in the sense of a pseudo spin. It's just two discrete states, but it does happen to be true that they also have opposite spins. All right, let me just say a couple of things, and then I'll stop, and I'll give up on saying anything about exit time. So the consequences of this is that if we inject charge, this thing basically is a lunger liquid. If I inject charge, I can get some in there, but you can convince yourself that, in fact, a IV that you would get from such a geometry is a power law IV, like other Schrodinger liquid. And you could also look at what happens if you couple this to a Bulkley, and basically what you discover is that the coupling to the Bulkley introduces a new term in your effective action, which sort of standard renormalization that we can do on this, and you find that it's either relevant or irrelevant, so that the coupling will be either relevant or irrelevant. In that case, I would say the system, either it is relevant, we would guess that the system is all becoming sort of one metal, probably with the regular Schrodinger liquid. And if it's irrelevant, then the Schrodinger liquid behavior would persist. One thing that's interesting about this that makes it different than edge states in the usual quantum Hall system is that this anomalous dimensions, kappa, which basically is the power that you get in this type of system, power that you get in the IV in this type of experiment, in principle can be adjusted, because this parameter here turns out is related to the confinement potential of the domain wall. You can imagine playing with that with gate geometries and actually changing this power, you know, by changing some gating geometry. And in the usual quantum Hall case, that's not supposed to be possible. Usually the power is set by just the bulk density. And here things are different. So this has some similarities, but some important differences from usual quantum Hall testing. So I guess I'm over time. I won't say anything about this. If you're interested, please come find me. I'll just jump to my summary. And these are the things I actually did say. I'll stop there. Thank you. Okay.
So we'll take one question before we move to the next speaker.
It may be a question to Don, not to you. So as far as interaction with deep Landau levels seems to be quantitatively important, will this affect the energetics of spin gaps and intervalic gaps and the SU4 symmetry that you know, discussed in graphene, or it's something which will be very small?
Well,
this logarithm that Alan was...
Right, yeah, so that logarithm actually appears in the part of the talk that I didn't present. I think the symmetry that I just talked about in terms of the domain well will not be lost, right? So we still have this broken symmetry state. But I think basically the question is quantitative, and I'm not sure if it's large or small, I think it'll just affect the numbers.
Well, for example, if you calculate the skirmion energy, will it be affected by that, or it will cancel out?
I don't think it will cancel out exactly. I don't think if you took just a two-band model that you'd get the same answer as if you kept all of those levels. But again, I think the number is quantitative. I don't think it